Almost every cyber breach has one thing in common: a human being. Whether it's clicking on a phishing email or rushing past a warning message or simply being overwhelmed by the pressures of work, people are often labeled as the weakest link in cybersecurity. But is that really fair? Should the responsibility for safer behavior fall solely on individual employees or on the organizations and cultures that shape how they work? This is a vital question, especially considering that the world of technology is raising the stakes every single day. So what can we do about it? And what can we learn about a scientist who discussed this problem 140 years ago? I'm Steve Prentice, and this is the Talis Security Sessions podcast. To help us understand this seemingly never-ending conundrum, I am joined today by Bruce Hallis, founder of the organization Rethinking the Human Factor, author and expert in human behavior. It is such a pleasure to have you here, Bruce. Welcome to the Talis Security Sessions podcast.
Steve, thank you very much for having me on the show. An absolute pleasure, and I'm glad we've been able to cram in between the various bits and pieces within the calendar.
To start off, can you tell us a little bit about your company, you know, what it does exactly and why it exists?
Rethinking the Human Factor was actually the title I gave to a research program I kicked off in 2012. And prior to 2012 and the research program, my background was GRC, so governance, risk and compliance. But, you know, even before that, I actually trained in law, finance and marketing. And my early career success, if you wanted to call it success, was that I became the go-to person for communicating what the IT function was talking about. The IT director and the IT management team were talking about security in the IT security context, but they really needed to get the exec board on board. And what I was able to, because of my education, was I could communicate to the lawyer, I could communicate to the marketing, I could communicate to finance. I became a translator, really. And that was all about communicating to people in the language they understood and using things that they felt were important. I was that go-to middle piece. Middleware would be the tech term, wouldn't it? Yeah. So I was a middleware. So I did GRC for a number of years, and I really enjoyed GRC. But one of the frustrations I guess I had was that I would, in effect, write down what were the acceptable behaviors within an organization. I document them in policies, processes, and procedures. Some of it, we got some technology to enforce some of those things. And other things, it was left down to this phrase, education and awareness. And it wasn't always successful. And when I looked at it from a marketing perspective, I started to sort of like realize that, you know, actually, there's some lessons here which were really similar to the world of marketing. Want to raise awareness about product, they want to increase the likelihood that you're going to choose their product and that you're going to keep buying their product. And actually, culture has a major role to play in terms of, one, communicating, and two, decision making. So I've got some skills here, or at least some training, which I thought might apply. And I kicked off the research, took 2 years out from earning a living, kicked off the research program. And off the back of that research program, which still continues today, we have an ongoing commitment to doing research. We sort of got ourselves a really, really interesting and insightful encyclopedia, which is an old phrase, I know, but it's like this huge amount of information and insight. And the first thing we did was the podcast. The second thing we did was a really small book. And then the third thing we did was started doing training and coaching CISOs and education awareness managers and what we'd learn and sharing those insights.
So when it comes to security then, whether it's cybersecurity or corporate security or information security, what is it that we really need to rethink? Is it a meta thing, like a process, or is there some type of missing link in security that you can help people specifically with?
It's a great question. I think one of the things for me that came out of the research was the challenge isn't just in terms of how your CISO looks at education or how the organization does it. There are so many different forces at play which are shaping the challenge for the security professional that's responsible for influencing arguably the hardest part of security, which is, you know, human behavior and trying to shape this thing that they call culture. Mm-hmm. And I can give you a couple of examples of that. At an industry level, there are key stakeholders who could be making easier for those of us who have been in the responsibility of bringing around change within organizations. I always find it very interesting that the phrase education and awareness is still the phrase that is used by regulators and the courts. It's the phrase that's used by stakeholders who are responsible for national cybersecurity, for example. Yet, what people are held accountable for is behavior and culture.
Okay.
It would be great if those people responsible for documenting what is reasonable and appropriate within an industry sector or across industry sectors, within how courts interpret corporate behavior, it would be great if we could move it from that education awareness, which is where it started. Okay, that's fine. But what we recognize in the industry is to reduce risk, you're talking about influencing behavior and culture. Okay. And it seems to me that still today, people talk about this whole tick box mentality and just doing enough to get us over the line. Well, what if we redrew the line?
That's a great metaphor.
And we said, actually, it's about behavior and culture. That's what we're asking you to influence. By just changing those two words in any document, regulatory requirement, I think it would make the world a difference to those who are responsible for these positive outcomes, which are going to bring benefits to the organizations, but also to society generally. So, I mean, that's the big one for me, is it could really shift things if it was done at that level, organizational level. Then one of the things I guess I would say that would be a real step in the right direction comes down to, if you're looking at behavior and cultural change, then it's about building a team with the right skills to focus on behavior and culture change. So there are a lot of really very, very good people who are operating at an operational level, and they're delivering all manner of initiatives to try and bring around an increase in awareness and to hope that that's going to drive behavior and culture change, which I know is something that you're passionate about.
It is. I certainly have hopes that my work has been helpful as well. Do you feel that the organizational psychology track helps cut through some of the inertia? Is it becoming more recognized?
So there's a lot of skills sort of building up in that area, and uptake in the number of people coming in from more of a behavioral science psychology background, for example, change backgrounds. I think we need to see more of that. And I think what's going to drive more of that is decisions by CISO to say, well, look, it's education awareness, but we're looking at behavior and culture here. And actually, I need to build teams which are cognizant of what that even means. I mean, one of the things we found in our research when we spoke to people about culture is that even people with culture in their title, in most situations I've come across, don't have a definition of what culture means. It's difficult. You think, well, why did you sign up to a job when there was no clear definition about what it is that you're signing up to? And then you wonder, well, those organizations that created those roles, which said security culture manager, for example, so you're sure you got a definition of what you meant in the first place before you drew the job spec. You'd be surprised how many haven't. So I think there's some really simple basics that we could be getting, like anchors we could be throwing out there to build our teams. But what I will say is that over in the UK, National Cybersecurity Centre just released a new sort of framework. And for the first time that I've ever noticed, actually had a definition for culture. And I saw that and I thought, well, that's absolutely fine. That's a step in the right direction, having a definition for what we're talking about.
Douglas Adams would be proud, I must say. You know, the whole idea of having a job that focuses on culture without knowing what culture was about. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Douglas Adams and the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series, but that was his style, to talk about this kind of Kafkaesque mentality and make light of it as well, I might add. So let's bring this down to specifics. Let's talk about things like deepfakes or even phishing in terms of culture.
Right.
What we're looking at here is how we humans, the central and perpetual weak link in the cybersecurity chain, we keep falling for them, for phishing scams, social engineering, deepfakes. We click on this without thinking or because we're under pressure. So can you provide some advice as to how to modify culture and behavior, for example, to protect organizations by somehow changing the way that people react to these kinds of misleading but urgent messages?
I'll give you an example for myself. When I was going through the research and I was doing my own background reading, and I was reading from a number of different directors, Caldini, Ariely, Kaiman, etc., and through that process, I started to become very aware of how in the case of the world of marketing, marketeers might use it, whether they knew it or not, I didn't know, but how they would use this insight into how people make judgments and decisions to increase the likelihood that I would pick their product. I was actually shopping at an adventure retail outlet, let's say, and I went there with a purpose in mind to buy a specific thing. And as I was looking through the shelves, I came across this item. At the time, I'd just become a dad. And suddenly, you know, the whole idea of going to the beach and taking the kids to the beach and all of that sort of stuff. I was suddenly struck by this beach tent. And I really got into the beach tent. And then I was drawn to the price on the beach tent. And I was like, wow, that's a fantastic price. And it had the price and it had the comparative price, etc. And I almost bought it.
But
I stopped and I found myself thinking through what I had been learning about how people make judgments and decisions, sometimes which completely go against all sense of logic. To other people, they appear to be almost irrational. This is what you came to buy. This isn't what you wanted to buy. And you weren't going to spend that much money, even if it looks like it's a good deal. But I remember I turned around to my eldest daughter, who was quite young at the time. I said, this isn't what I came here to buy. And when I did my podcast interview with Dan Ariely, I mentioned it to him. I said, thank God to you, because I didn't end up buying that beach tent.
And just for some completion for the audience, let's clarify who Dan Ariely is and where he fits into this discussion.
So Dan Ariely is one of the world's best known behavioral scientists. And he is very much, in my mind, he's very much on the same level as a number of behavioral scientists that have won Nobel Prizes for basically the study, the understanding of behavioral economics, which in a really simple way is, you know, how do we make judgments and decisions? That's how it's been applied.
He is a fascinating character. He's an expert on the hidden forces that shape human decision making. And yeah, he shows how people often act against their own best interests in systematic and surprising ways, like buying unnecessary beach tents.
Yeah. The lesson from that is, when you actually invest the time in understanding how people make calls and under what circumstances those judgments and decisions might appear to be completely irrational. You know, they've done the training, they've passed the training, they're motivated, they know the implications of getting this wrong to the organization, to the individual whose personal data, for example, it is, and what it could even mean to them in their work. Okay. So even with all these things going for them, there are a range of circumstances, and you've mentioned one there, maybe they're under pressure, okay, where you're thinking, oh, okay, right, that's going to increase the likelihood that somebody, instead of using the logical side of their brain, is going to use the other bit, which is full of all these lovely shortcuts, which have been great for human evolution. But, you know, the reality is that cyber criminals know that everybody has to. You can't get away from them. And so they design things with that in mind. That's one lesson. But the big lesson that we've always tried to promote is that you've got cyber criminals using this insight to design their attacks to increase the likelihood of you complying with what they want in terms of behavior to enable that attack to go further.
There's an expression that says, when you are a hammer, everything looks like a nail, which people can sometimes look past as merely a turn of phrase. But when you think of it as a mindset, there's always this sharpness, for want of a better term, that for those people who are actively looking for something, especially something bad to do. Such a mindset makes it so much easier for them to notice things, weaknesses, opportunities, as compared to the rest of us.
The question I put to people is, well, why don't we use that to better design not just education and awareness programs, but the whole working environment to increase the security behavior that we want as security professionals, as business leaders? And I think that's the big thing about our piece of work was, everyone else is using us. Facebook, you go to LinkedIn, you go to Instagram, you go to all the big tech successes that we know of. All those platforms are designed to influence behavior. They want you to register. They want you to go back. They want you to interact, because all those things count against things which make their business a success.
So you asked the question, the big question, why? What answer did you get?
Why? I really do think that when I speak to people, one of the things that people say to me about how I help them is that we do the heavy lifting up front. Most people I speak to, their job roles include, or most people are sort of a CISO, head of education and awareness, right-hand person to the CISO responsible for the behavior and culture piece. Most of them have somewhere in their job spec a requirement to perform some research into the subject matter. Everyone I speak to hasn't got the time to do that. Mm-hmm. And when they do get it, what they're looking at are shortcuts to insight. And so they go to the industry. And I do feel at times, this is purely my observation, and there's no data behind it at all, but I do feel sometimes that we suffer from the bubble that we're in. And there are some voices which are much louder than others, partly funded by investment to tell a particular story and narrative, which is helpful to a certain degree, for sure, absolutely for sure. But in this world where the people who ultimately are responsible for implementing the behaviors within organizations and the culture within organizations, because they haven't got enough time to actually step away from the operational coalface and actually take the time to rethink the human factor, the problem they get is they get sucked into, where is the information that I can get to really quickly? And I think that environment, that space, is heavily influenced by a focus upon platforms that will do this for you, might incorporate behavioral science. And there's some really good stuff out there. But I guess our argument is, if you look beyond that, there's a lot you can do, okay, which doesn't involve following that particular route. But it's really hard for people because they just haven't got the time. And it's just the human nature, isn't it, to find the easiest solution to the apparent problem. And sometimes I think there's some confusion about what the problem is.
Yeah, and this is, I think, again, at the root of the problem, being that there's a lack of fundamental understanding of the danger. You know, the organizations are at risk, let's say, of being penetrated, being hacked, being breached, getting nation-state actors to come in and lurk, primarily by walking in, not breaking through the defenses of the network, but by exploiting some passive activity by a human being. You would assume, therefore, that being aware of this would be like leaving the keys of your car on the hood of your car. So no one would do that, right? Because they know exactly that an opportunistic thief, regardless of skills, would come and take it instantly. So there seems to be an absolute fundamental presence of the knowledge of the danger that allowing people to fall prey to these things exists. But as you said, the culture of the organization is one where maybe they're just simply delegating the responsibility to CISOs and others to do their research as and when they can, which is never possible, never available. And it just seems to get swept under the rug to some degree. I'll give you one example myself, if I may. I read about a number of email servers, internal email servers that scan emails for malware. And in some cases, employees who are expecting their emails complain because their emails aren't coming in fast enough. You know, they have to wait a few seconds while the organization scans this. And so they say, no, I haven't got time for that. So the actual consumer pressure internally was that we don't want to run the defense because it's costing each employee a few seconds of waiting time before they get their mail. So there have been cases where they would actually allow a number of emails to pass through the servers unchecked because of internal consumer pressure. So how can we battle that?
Right. I mean, I think it's really interesting, the example you gave of the email and the fact that somebody feels that they have to raise the fact that there's a delay in me receiving the email, even if it's short. And that's a flow of information. And the first one I would be thinking of is you always get people who, quite frankly, say, it could be better. I want it better. But if you've got 95% of the workforce covered, then you're okay. And some people argue, well, maybe that 5% are all the most powerful people within the organization. And there is the argument as well. In some organizations, information flow is absolutely critical. I mean, you think about the stock exchange, for example, and people in those sort of financial industries, information turning up a couple of seconds earlier than our competitors can be the difference between a really good day and a really average day. So those type of industry sectors have a different from an impact assessment. You think, okay, if this happens, what does that mean to the KPIs of the business? There are a lot of businesses where, you know, a 5-second delay, a 30-second delay, you know, a 5-minute delay really isn't going to have an impact upon the actual things which are important to the business. You might have an individual that says, hey, can I have it now? actually, in terms of how we prioritize things within the business, we're looking for things which are good for the business, not necessarily good for the individual. And to have that conversation with them when they understand, you know, why that decision's being made, not to actually comply with their request. But importantly, you know, there's a behavioral aspect there in the sense that when people communicate to you as an opportunity for improvement, it should be recognized, you should get considered, and you should get back with your answer. It's something that I've noticed over the years where, you know, people run surveys, for example, then people invest the time to complete the survey. They share, you know, opportunities for improvement, and then no one gets back to them.
Yes.
And then we wonder why the number of people who keep responding to surveys might potentially drop. That's a real problem. Are you thinking about security being more prevalent rather than, is it about how often people come into contact with security? Is it the numbers game? It's about, instead of once a year, we use some training, or is it, you know, do we see security on an ongoing basis?
Yes, yeah, making it ongoing. I mean, the thing about, you know, all these streaming media outlets is they've got the algorithms to continue to drive people to come back. But they take notice of what they are interested in, of course, and they supply more of the same. So obviously there's a technology there to stimulate people into certain kinds of action. But what I've seen, as you said, is the once per year training session that nobody ever pays attention to. You know as well as I do that people forget most of what they learned in the span of a few days and up to 90% in the span of a few weeks. And it becomes Herman Ebbinghaus. Props to him.
Yeah, Ebbinghaus. Yeah, absolutely.
Just for clarity, Herman Ebbinghaus was a psychologist who lived in the mid-1800s. And he's famous, of course, for the Ebbinghaus curve, which is the hockey stick downwards projection of forgetfulness after people learn things without reinforcing it. So, you know, this is 140 years old. We haven't learned a thing. So it just seems a shame, obviously, to when we're looking at culture and behavior. And what I'd love to do to wrap this episode up is to say, well, you know, what advice would you give to people or to organizations to assist in blending culture and behavior into a better and more proactive approach to cybersecurity from a psychological and cultural perspective? What advice can you give to frustrated CISOs or executives on how to blend your wisdom to make their organizations safer at the speed it needs to be done?
Okay. I think the inherent problem there is the speed point, because culture doesn't change quickly and even behaviors don't change quickly. The only way you can quickly do these things is to take away the choice.
Ah,
that is an option. When I work with people and they talk about behavioral change, maybe we just take the choice away from them. But you have to be careful about doing that, because what that potentially does is it takes away the flexibility, the mental flexibility that people sometimes need to come up with the new ideas, the new process, find the new ways of doing things, which are going to be the great new product or service or reduce your operating costs by X. You don't want to kill off creativity and innovation within an organization. You need to create an environment where that can be done, and security is an essential part of that consideration and that process. Obviously, that takes time, but that is a quick way of getting down to behavior by just taking the choice out. But the other thing I think it sort of erodes is the trust relationship between employees and organizations. And some people say there is no trust before I go, I get paid, I do the job for them, etc. But I think there is always an aspect of trust. There is questions about overreach in terms of looking into monitoring absolutely every keystroke, how often somebody's at a screen, etc., or a keyboard. So I think there's some ethical questions that we're going to be looking at in the near future as an industry, especially as AI comes in and makes things even more, you know, quick and accessible if we want it. The question is not just do we want it, it's like should we want it? For me, a really simple thing around the behavioral side is you've got to choose, just like you choose to have a firewall, just like you choose to have anti-malware and all these controls. From a behavioral perspective, you've got to choose which behavioral framework model is going to be your standard for trying to influence behavior. What I'm seeing a lot of, admittedly through the research, et cetera, so it might not be the whole picture across the industry, I suspect it's not necessarily. But what I see is that a lot of people talk about behavioral influence and trying to get behavioral outcomes. And then I say to them, well, what behavioral models are you using? And they're not using any.
That's not helpful.
So if you want to have a chat with the regulator and say, yeah, you know, if your CEO wants to stand up and go, yes, we knew that we might have an incident. Yes, we recognize that and there might be behaviors which aren't compliant with our policy. Okay, so what did you try to do to influence that? and you haven't got a response, an effective one that is demonstrable within a court of law, in front of the media, in front of your stakeholders, you can't really demonstrate that you've taken it even reasonably seriously, because you talk about behavior, but you haven't actually got any sort of behavioral framework that you're trying to apply. So it's down to luck,
yeah,
or it's down to just education and awareness. And what we both talked about already today is, you know, that stuff gets forgotten within 100 days because Ebbinghaus.
Because Ebbinghaus. That captures so much. It highlights both the human capacity and incapacity to adopt new knowledge or skills, in that we can, given enough time, support, and practice, we can develop those skills. It also shines a light on the often misguided policies that stand behind cybersecurity best practices. For example, that all users will get it the first time and will stick with the program, when that is just not physiologically or psychologically possible. Bruce Hallis, this has really been a treat. We both share a passion for the human factor and the way that people learn and interact, and hearing your perspectives has really been so enjoyable. It's the side of security that sometimes gets left in the shadows, and it was very kind of you to cast some light upon this. So thank you so much for joining me today here on the Talos Security Sessions podcast.
I'm always happy to have a chat with somebody who clearly knows their stuff as well. So, you know, some great questions in there relating to the challenges that, you know, CISOs and the heads of education and awareness are facing. So really, it's great to come on the show, and I hope that your listeners get something from the topics that we discussed today.
As do I. Remember, if you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe and to tell a friend or a colleague or a client or all of them about the Talos Security Sessions podcast series, not just for the next episode, but for our valuable and thorough collection of past ones. All on the topics that you need to know about to successfully carry on in the business of information security. We will be back again soon with another timely discussion. And until then, I'm Steve Prentice. Thanks for listening.